This is EdgeCases. I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Wolf French.
And what's our topic this week, Wolf?
Crypto humility.
I don't know what that is.
Hopefully at the end of the show you'll know.
Okay. Now, you didn't make up a term, right? This is a real term?
No, I just made that up.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, hey, it's your turn.
Yeah.
All right. So I don't think we have any feedback or FU. So we can get started.
Okay, good, because it's one of the dense shows. So I'll start off with a great blog posting by Tony Arcieri. I'm butchering his name, but I'll put a link in. And the title of the article of the blog posting is "All the Crypto Code You've Ever Written Is Probably Wrong Is Probably Broken."
Yeah. All right. Yeah.
And it's a really great article. I recommend reading it. But I'll give you kind of the thrust of it here. And the basic problem is that, and I'll quote him here, most of the cryptographic APIs you've ever encountered have probably made you run a gambit of choices for how you want to encrypt data. And so I'll give you a kind of rundown of like the type, if you just want to do things like just symmetrically encrypt a block of data, what you have to make a ton of choices. And the choices you make are probably going to be wrong. So you have to first off decide on the block cipher. So AES is pretty much has kind of won that. So let's assume AES. So, but that I'll talk about that a little bit later. The big thing you have to decide is the mode of operation. There's this mode of operation known as electronic codebook, and it is apparently often the default in cryptographic libraries, and it's just terribly broken. Wikipedia has a I'll make sure I put a link to Wikipedia here about it. Wikipedia has this great example of like the Tux the Penguin, the Linux logo, encrypted with electronic codebook, and you actually can totally make out the penguin even after it's been encrypted. I won't go into too much detail here, but this is well known for crypto guys. If you're not aware of this, you can read on Wikipedia what's wrong with it. So there's this other mode called cipher blockchaining, which is the usual choice, but it actually has a bunch of problems too. It requires an initialization vector, and that has usability problems. And it also doesn't ensure data integrity. And it also needs padding, which makes it vulnerable to a chosen cipher text attack. And so Ronald Bowes wrote this great article called "Padding Oracle Attacks in Depth." And I'll include a link of that in the show notes. And the padding oracle attack is a great attack. He points out that often padding is a good kind of attack vector on this type of stuff, this takes advantage of some padding, how padding works, and kind of the side effects of it. And he includes code there, like a little GitHub repo that reproduces the problem and walks you through it, and it's a great way to figure out how this stuff works. And now there's this other mode called counter or CTR, which is kind of the newish hotness. It's been around for a while, but that's kind of the default choice for a certain class. And it's basically a mode that turns a block cipher into a streaming cipher. Unfortunately, it does require a nonce, a nonce is a fancy cryptographic term for a non-repeatable kind of token or number that should not be repeated ever again. And interesting thing about CTR is that it was recommended by this book called Cryptography Engineering, but now is not. Now CBC is recommended. And that has to do because of, usability, which I'll talk about. And I'll include a link to Wikipedia there on how CTR works. So the basic problem here is that because these modes of CBC and CTR don't supply authentication, it turns out you actually want to authenticate your data. If you don't authenticate it, then you leave yourself open to a class of attacks like the Oracle padding attack and basically any chosen cipher text attack. So by authenticating, you can make sure that you're not just kind of randomly decrypting the data that is given to you. That's something that you should be decrypting. And usually when people think, I need to authenticate something, I'm going to use a hashing algorithm, and what do you know? There's this thing called secure hash algorithm, and that has the word secure in it. And Ben Adida wrote this great blog post back in 2008 called "Don't Hash Secrets," who points out that you actually don't want to use SHA-1 or any of the SHA variants directly, because these algorithms are actually, it's kind of interesting, because what ends up happening is that these hash algorithms kind of end up just kind of dumping their internal BitBlender state right into the key, and that can be resurrected and then extended. So they're vulnerable to a class of attack known as hash extension attacks. And Ronald Bowles, who I mentioned before, also wrote a great blog posting about everything you need to know about hash length extension attacks, where he also includes code and how to pull off these types of attacks.
Can you really? I mean, hashes are such a compression of all of that original data. You can really walk your way backward just from a hash number?
It's not so much that you walk your way backwards. It's more you take that hash and you, based on the hash, you repopulate all the little variables inside these BitBlenders. And then you can add more data at the end, and you can achieve the same hash at the end.
So you can recreate the hash with your own modified data.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So what you really want to do is use this thing called a message authentication code, or hash function message authentication code, or HMAC. And Tony does this great thing that really I think you brought the point home. He's saying, okay, so you have this problem, and you have these cryptographic primitives, and so you know you need to use authentication code to encrypt your data so a certain class of attack that we're just assuming you know there is this class of attack, which is a problem in itself. So what exactly do you do? Do you first encrypt the data, and then you apply the message authentication code? That is, you encrypt the plaintext, compute the MAC of the plaintext, and append the MAC of the plaintext to the ciphertext. Or do you encrypt then MAC? That is, you encrypt and MAC, or do you encrypt then MAC? Which is, you encrypt the plaintext, compute the MAC of the ciphertext, and append the MAC of the ciphertext to the ciphertext. So that's a little bit different than the previous one. The previous one, you were appending the MAC of the plaintext to the ciphertext. The second one was, you're appending the MAC of the ciphertext to the ciphertext. So, because you have these, you can do things in different orders, right? Or you can even then MAC and then encrypt, which is you generate a message authentication code of the plaintext, append the MAC to the plaintext, and then encrypt the plaintext and the MAC. And it turns out that all these seemingly work, but they all have different trade-offs. And the correct answer is actually number two, which you encrypt, then MAC. But the point is that you probably wouldn't get this right. Like, you have these magic tokens that you're stringing together, and it turns out the order you put them in is actually very important, and it's not altogether obvious how to string these things together correctly. And the thing is that you often will get it will look like it's working, which I'll address a little bit later. So Matthew Green, who's on Twitter, I should put a little note here that I link to his blog and Twitter. He did a panel discussion at this USENIX conference known as HotSec 2013, which I think is a terrible name. But
woo, HotSec.
HotSec.
I want to have some HotSec.
And his panel discussion description, I think it's so great that I'm just going to quote it here because it's actually the best write-up I've heard, as pretty short. For decades, the security community has waited for cryptographic software to become ubiquitous. To some extent, we've achieved that goal. Hundreds of modern applications employ strong cryptography. Many of these applications are not security tools per se, which means that non-expert developers have increasingly become consumers of cryptographic technology. Unfortunately, our cryptographic libraries have not been redesigned with this consumer in mind. Most of the popular libraries support complex and non-intuitive APIs that present the developer with numerous choices, many of which are insecure. The result is that even experienced developers routinely select dangerous combinations. The visible consequence is a superabundance of security vulnerabilities in recent cryptographic software, including SSL implementations that fail to properly check certificates, widespread of unauthenticated encryption, RSA with exponent 1, and continued use of dangerous encryption padding schemes. These flawed library APIs, often viewed as mild eccentricity, or at worst, a way to dissuade non-experts. In this session, I'll argue that this view is fundamentally dangerous and counterproductive. Thousands of open source projects currently list OpenSSL's libcrypto as its core dependency, and a surprising number are finding their way into critical niches within our ecosystem. Indeed, years of careful security research are often foiled by the design of library interfaces. Perhaps worst of all, these legacy APIs are being reflected in brand new efforts, such as the proposed W3C web cryptography API for some browser-based cryptography. As a consequence, we'll all be facing these problems for years to come. And so that's basically the thrust of what this episode is about, is that in general, programmers are accidental domain experts. And the term I invented for this is that we're domain tourists. Because, like, programming itself is a domain, but unfortunately it's a domain that by itself doesn't really do anything. I mean, sure, we could just add numbers together all day, but that isn't useful. So what programmers are we go into other problem domains, and we're tourists of them. That if we're really lucky, the best software is when you have a person who is both is very good at programming and very good at another domain. That way they can know everything about both domains simultaneously. But unfortunately, we tend to be domain tourists. And I am not a cryptographer, and I am a cryptography tourist. And so I'm interested. I take photos of the sites and I read about it, but I'm not an expert in that problem domain, and I doubt I ever will be. And unfortunately, this tends to lead to two problems. It leads to the I heard of it cryptographic choices mentality, which is you're faced with a problem, and I don't want this to devolve into the grep thing, so regular expressions thing, but you're faced with a problem, you know, and you say, oh, I need to block cipher this, or I need to what was the last thing I heard of? Like, oh, I use AES for this. And it's kind of a popularity choice, and it's not a really deep understanding of the trade-offs involved. And that again is because you're not a domain expert on cryptography, you're more of a consumer of it. And the second thing is that majority of software developed today, the vast majority, probably on the order of 99% of software developed today, it follows the mythology of test and fix, whereas all software starts off broken, and then we refine it until it's not obviously broken anymore. And the problem with cryptography is how it interacts with that methodology, if you can even call it a methodology, is that you can create things that don't seem obviously broken to your non-domain expert eye, but it's subtly broken. And that's exactly what can be a weakness that can be leveraged against your software.
Yeah, it's like tech journalism. I mean, we often people who have been the subject of articles and in journals and websites and things talk about how, you know, they get it wrong most of the time. And that's because they kind of swoop in and they try to get their facts together, and then maybe they do a little bit of fact checking, and then they swoop out and they write their article. And, you know, it's usually not enough.
Yeah, that's
for them to get it all completely right.
Yeah, I haven't put that together, but yeah, that's exactly the same problem. Yeah. I guess journalists basically have the same problem as we do when they try to cover a story, that they're not domain tourists like we are. And God, sure. And then domain tourists covering domain tourists. Wow. That's us. You can see why it's like the telephone game. They can get a lot of stuff wrong in a short amount of space. So discussions like this always kind of come back to a famous or infamous book called Applied Cryptography. And so my story with Applied Cryptography is that I was very excited to find it on the shelf of Barnes & Noble when I was young. And I actually have, you know, I'm so hipster, I had the blue cover book, not the later red cover book. Well, actually, I had that one too, but I read that thing cover to cover probably like three times. I was a big fan. And it was a kind of an interesting kind of, I don't know, my personal rebellious story against the state man, because it was... I knew that the information in Applied Cryptography was classified as munitions by the federal government. So that was, you know, basically dangerous knowledge, right? Like, this is illegal in certain countries, right? Could not export this. So that felt really good. And plus, I was a teenager. So it's like, teenage power, like having this like illegal knowledge in my hands, and gave me all sorts of feelings of power there. And so Matthew Green, which I mentioned before, who did the hot sec panel, he has a good blog post, which I'll link to, called In Defense of Applied Cryptography, where he kind of – Applied Cryptography has basically gotten a rep for people like me with people like me. I'm basically pointing the accusatory finger at myself here, that basically the type of people who – are attracted to cryptography but aren't the experts, aren't the domain experts, tend to love this book. And and the problem with Applied Cryptography is that I believe let me click through this link so I get the quote exactly right, because it's a great quote. Yes, he says, applied cryptography is laid it all out there, all the cryptography stuff. So applied cryptography just laid it all out there, sans apology, like a copy of anarchist cookbook left open in a middle school library. And that's pretty much exactly the kind of feeling of it, is that it unapologetically says, these are the primitives, these are how things work. And if you don't know kind of the larger kind of practical aspects of how cryptography fails, even though in defense of Bruce Schneier, who wrote Applied Cryptography, he does have a bunch of warnings, even the Blue Book, about how this stuff isn't, how the algorithms he explains aren't strong, you shouldn't use them. But people tend to kind of go into it like they view it as a toolbox. And even though what they really need is a hammer, they pull out a really big wrench and they use that instead. So it was misused by people like me to a great extent.
Well, I would think you would be a proponent of the use of wrenches.
There you go. Yeah. I just fixed my bike the other day by bashing a big wrench onto a seat post. So that is
there you go
on my mind. So it has this kind of this rep in the community, and it, almost as penance, some people say, but I don't really think it's penance. There is this book that came out with Bruce Schneier again, but co-written with Niels Ferguson and I forget the guy's first name, but Kono, and it's. Basically, it's where applied cryptography was more, here are the primitives and here, you know, the raw primitives, and this is how the stuff exactly works. Cryptography engineering says design principles and practical applications is the kind of subtitle, where they lay out a lot of the kind of more modern stuff. There's a few things that didn't get into applied cryptography because cryptography is getting up on years now, so it's more modern. But it also includes recommendations saying, do things this way. So it's much, so it's, it is in many ways more practical to people who need to use cryptography, who consume cryptography, instead of having to like build their own primitives or exactly put the stuff together. And there's actually a bunch of common mistakes that it addresses. I already mentioned the electronic codebook mode. That's a terrible thing to do. But other common mistakes are like zero initialization vectors, unseeded randomness, or even weak randomness. I don't know if you how on top of this you are, but have you heard about the Android apps that have been generated weak bitcoins?
I don't think so.
Yeah, so, you know, so Bitcoin hinges on public key cryptography, and basically what Bitcoin boils down to is a public-private key pair type stuff. And it turns out that there is that there's an app for Android that could generate Bitcoin. Well, you could generate public-private key pairs, whatever, that you could use as addresses to send your Bitcoins. And those Bitcoins were able to be quote-unquote stolen. If as much as you can steal a non-physical item, which is, I guess, a point of philosophy. But those were stolen out of the blockchain. And this ended up being tracked down to that the Java cryptography architecture is that, I'll quote them here, and I'll include a link to the blog post. We have now determined that applications which use the Java cryptography architecture, or the JCA, for key generation signing or random number generation may not receive cryptographically strong values on Android devices due to improper initialization of the underlying pseudo-random number generator. So,
wow.
Yeah, so that, but, you know, this is interesting because I think that flaw has been in there for a while. And this kind of took the money incentive for people to actually notice that things were going missing. their money has gone missing.
Well, or people could have been breaking the cryptography of certain applications and not making a big fuss about it.
Yeah, pretty much. That's one of the things and why these bug bounties are so important. is because, you know, organized crime, they can totally use, you know, they're well-funded and they can use this stuff to, you know, they can make money off all 0 days. And so by companies like Google offering bug bounties, you know, $10,000, $50,000 for finding new exploits against their software, they're putting money on the table as well. And usually it's not, often it's not enough, but at least it's there. So if you want to be a white hat, you can. So I already plugged cryptography engineering. And so I will say that, so that brings us to OpenSSL. And OpenSSL is, I kind of lump it together in my mind under the applied cryptography book, is that it gives you a toolbox of primitives. And how you put those together is totally up to you. And let me tell you, it's not a friendly API whatsoever. And it is, and also... It's not particularly well written. In fact, there was this Twitter account. I'll see if I can dig it up, put a show link in there, about basically them kind of scouring the OpenSSL code base.
The daily bug.
It kind of bug
or whatever. So like bad code.
Bad code, yes.
I subscribed to that too for a while.
Okay, yes. Yeah, so we'll include a link on that. But, you know, practically all shipping code has its bodies buried in there. So don't take it totally out of context. And this stuff is battle-hardened. You know, this obviously is a pressure point here of if you can find a flaw in OpenSSL, then a bunch of apps fall. So, and so there, you know, it has fixes for things in there for different platforms, multi-platform. So I'm not as hard on as a lot of people are, but it's not ideal for the person's hand because again, you and me are cryptographic consumers that we aren't actually so interested in stringing together our own primitives to design our own system. We kind of want the higher level interface. And that kind of leads me to Daniel Bernstein's project, which he calls SALT. And this is very sad. So Daniel Bernstein is famous. He owns crypto with a bunch of peers in it as a domain name. And I think it was a Qmail, and I think we mentioned him before. But he has this thing called the Networking and Cryptography Library, and he shortened it up to NACL. And oh, look, NACL, when it's shortened, and well, that's calcium chloride, right? So that's salt. And so you're supposed to pronounce NACL as salt. And unfortunately, this was – I figure we announced it was back in like 2008 that he announced it, or maybe that's when Google announced theirs. But Google also has this thing called Native Client, which they also thought would be very nerd funny if they named it NACL as well. So there's basically two not competing projects, but they're two separate projects. But it's very confusing if you Google for NACL. I don't think Bernstein's library even comes up on the first page of Google. You actually have to Google for NACL crypto, and then you'll find it. But let's keep things straight, and because I think it's overly clever to refer to it as salt, I'm just going to call it DJB NACL. And I will never refer to NACL as itself, and I won't call it salt because then you won't know what I'm talking about. So we'll just call it NACL. Anyway, so I was very excited about NACL when it first came out. And it seemed to be like hit the sweet spot of the idea that you really want this much more, you want much higher level API. Well, it will find the randomness for you. It will make sure it's strong randomness. It will choose the padding schemes, choose the ciphers, choose the modes, choose the digital signature algorithms, the MAC algorithms, use them all correctly and bring it together under one sane API. And so I thought this is exactly what it needed.
And a pony?
Yeah, and ponies in there too. Unfortunately, it had a bunch of problems. And so DJB is a really smart guy, and he tends to be unsatisfied with the state of the world, and he tends to go off and build his own things. And so it turns out that NACL, DJB NACL, had a bunch of problems. There is another project that aimed to solve this problem by building on NACL called Sodium. And I'll take their bullet points of the problems with DJB's NACL, which is while each primitive comes with one or more portable implementations, NACL itself is not portable. In particular, it only can be compiled on some Unix flavors. NACL ships with constructions that were just prototypes and shouldn't be used anymore. The compiled code is only guaranteed to work on the machine it was compiled on. and that NACL is not a shared library, make it difficult to use in other programming languages, and it hasn't been designed to be installed system-wide. And that packaging NACL for different operating systems is tough due to a specific build system and compile time requirements. So essentially, DJB NACL is very Unix-y in the idea that you will compile it on the system you want to use it on, and you will compile it. It won't generate like a shared library that you can copy across different systems that could possibly work. And you will eventually wind up, it will figure out, and you should see this build system, man. It's crazy that it will actually as part of the build system, which of course, DJB being a smart guy, he wrote his own build system too, called Redo, which I understand is pretty fun, but again, this is not something I really want, I'm not interested in when I'm just trying to use a crypto library, especially a high level one where I want to kind of not have to care about this stuff and kind of put it in a domain expert's hands. His thing will actually go through and will compile a bunch of different implementations and select the one that is fastest and then use that one. And I don't know if he even like chooses different algorithms based on that, but I wouldn't be surprised. But that seems like a really bad idea. But anyway, let me tell you.
Well, see, the build system runs like races.
Yes.
Before being done with its build.
Yes.
That's hardcore.
It is, and I could not. I cannot think of how I could make this less iPhone friendly. Like when you're trying to build a binary that works across devices, and like it's one thing is like you're trying to compile Mac OS 10 app or something, but you're on your Mac, you're compiling like x86, but you're targeting like ARM, and it has no idea about what's going on there, and let alone you want to do a fat binary for different architectures. This is totally unfriendly to basically the Mac and especially the iPhone. So I was very disappointed.
Can you imagine trying to ship an iPhone app where like, okay, the first time you run it, I've got to compile something on your phone and then run some tests and then pick the one and then, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Apple would be totally down with that.
Totally.
Yeah. So Sodium is basically a project that makes DJB NACL usable by the common case, which is, people doing prepackaged apps like we're doing. And so I'll include a link to that. And it's actually pretty recent. They just shipped it in March of 2013. So I'm hoping that breathes a lot of new life into DJB's NACL. I don't think Bernstein himself is too interested in the project because he thinks NACL is just great the way it is because he's a Unix guy. But I'm hoping that that will help a lot. There's a couple of related projects as well. Google has a project called Keysar, which is very much along the same lines that they include high-level APIs that make all of these decisions for you and are kind of optimized for ease of use. And there's also GPG, which stands for GNU Privacy Guard, has libgpg, which is essentially kind of fulfills the same niche as OpenSSL in terms of being a toolbox for cryptographic primitives. But I think it's better written, but I'm not 100% sure. OpenSSL seems to be the default choice because of the entire GPL issue. Although, for all I know, maybe libgpg is LGPL, but, we'd like to stay away from GPL in general. And it has a project called GPG Made Easy, or GPGME, which is kind of hard to say. But that seems to be also in the same class of these higher-level cryptographic APIs. I asked on Twitter what people thought about it, and I haven't gotten any response back. So I think it's just not well-known and not well-used. And one of the things I should mention here is that as we're talking about crypto and kind of higher level interfaces to it, is that Apple introduced a cryptographic system called Secure Transform for Mac OS X, which is crazily not on iOS yet. They introduced it back in like 10.7, and like, okay, so you're interested in 10.7, like surely the next version of iOS will have it, which would be at that time was iOS 6. Nope. And man, wouldn't it be crazy if that wasn't on iOS 7.2? That'd just be triple crazy.
Well, it's not like you need things to be secure on iOS.
Yes.
That's not a big deal.
Yeah. And so Secure Transform is definitely better than OpenSSL, just from an API usage. And also has like some nice, like it leverages Grand Central Dispatch to do multi-core, and you kind of have a more high-level API where you describe what you want done instead of doing it. However, it is actually kind of low-level. that you're still making decisions and how you point things together, and that's pretty much exactly the use case that gets you in trouble. So I can't say that secure transform is the way to go. I would still be looking at things like Sodium and Kezar and maybe even GPGME. And one thing is that whenever I read a lot of crypto, I think about crypto a lot. It's like I always tend to learn stuff, and it's always very interesting. And I always tend to feel good at the end. It's like, oh, I know stuff I didn't know before, and maybe even an ego stroking thing. Like, look at me, I'm so smart, I can figure all this stuff out, all that. And after listening to this episode, I want to make it very clear that I am not expert at this. I'm not a cryptographer. I'm just a cryptography tourist. I'm just a consumer of the stuff. That I am wrong about some of the stuff you've listened to in this episode, almost guaranteed, because this stuff is very hard, very tricky. I'm sure I got something wrong here. I didn't talk about things like side channel attacks or timing attacks. I didn't talk about how to store strong passwords. So all this stuff has its own little rabbit holes to go down. And by the way, if you're storing passwords, you should use Bcrypt. But I'll include a bonus link to that, so you should know that. You shouldn't be using Salt. And so my basic thrust is that crypto is its own field with domain experts. And cryptography is its own field, and that's really separate from the computer security experts. Like, penetration testers is its own domain as well. And that tends to interact with the cryptography guys, but the cryptography guys are their own domain experts. And so the bottom line here is that this is really, it's too big for you to know everything. And so my advice boils down to be cryptographically humble, know that you're wrong, and try to use as high level APIs as you can. That's it.
that's your episode?
That's my episode. I came in a lot faster than I thought.
You were going about 1,000 miles an hour. Well, there were a couple of things where you said, "Well, I'll get back to that later." Did you get back to all of those things?
I think so. Unfortunately, this stuff is kind of like I wanted to do a good intro of like the type of domain knowledge you need with Tony's article to get the stuff right, and that introduced a bunch of problems that I end up addressing later on. So I put a few forward links in there, but I think I filled all of them.
Okay. Well, can you? Actually, so there's two things, I guess. One is I remember that you had these two guys on and the C4.
Yeah.
Who were, I don't remember exactly how they built themselves.
That was Thomas Tachek, Nate McFetters, and now I'm spacing on the other guy, Mike something, I think.
Was it three guys?
It was three guys,
Was. Okay. Mm-hmm. Is that recorded anywhere?
That is recorded, and I don't think I've ever uploaded that video, if I have that video, so... I won't be up for the time of this episode, but yes, it was.
Sure.
But they basically argued the type of same thing. Like, basically,
yes.
They don't worry about the stuff. Use highest level APIs as you can.
Right. And their thrust, which I think is quite similar to what you're talking about here, is that, you know, if you, do the best you can. But it was kind of this weird thing where, like, you know, basically, the more you try to be tricky and get it right, mm-hmm. you're probably just going to get it wrong.
Yeah.
So do what you can, because it's all just screwed anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Which was actually a mindset which goes well with this podcast, actually. another thing is, you know, you mentioned a lot of details, especially at the beginning, and certainly there are more details about the things you should probably know if you're going to be doing this stuff in detail, which we can't cover. But have there been any projects that you could talk about, you know, recently where you tried to use cryptography and you said, all right, here's the best that I can do on this project?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think it was earlier this year, I was on a project that hasn't shipped yet that had to use a good amount of cryptography specifically public key and cryptography. And what I ran into, I was that I was very excited about DJP Knackle, and that's when I actually tried to use it for the first time, and I realized mm-hmm. its horrendous nature. And it ended up being that I had to end up using OpenSSL because I had to use a certain type of elliptic curve encryption, which is part of the problem with when you use these libraries. It's all well and good to say, oh, I have, you know, this, you make all these decisions for me. But it turns out that often the problem domain dictates, dictates of what type of cryptography you need to use. You need to specify, and that could be you. The common case probably is that, oh, I need to interoperate with this other system, and they've made these choices.
Right. Mm-hmm.
In my case, I actually wanted to go with a certain type of lifted curve encryption due to data size that it needs to fit in a UDP packet. So that there's a few tricks you can play with how you can make you can extract the key from a public key from a signed packet type stuff. That's a trick that you only can pull off with the lifted curve, as far as I'm aware. And so, but that's exactly the type of thing where, like, I then need to delve in and use OpenSSL directly, warts and all,
yeah.
You know, because I needed that fine grain control. And I really wish I could use a higher level API for that, but unfortunately I couldn't.
Right. Yeah. The case that I remember from the last couple of years is encrypted SQLite databases. Mm-hmm. And I think, if I'm remembering correctly, it has been a little while, you can do that, but you can't use the SQLite that comes with iOS,
right,
or Mac. So you need to build your own.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't that also you have to pay like a licensing fee for that or something like that?
Do you have to do that if you? I don't remember what the licensing.
I know there's like some extensions where you have to license extra features for SQLite. I know that's part of the revenue model. I don't know if that's one of them.
I don't know either. I don't remember that particular aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that it seemed like there were projects out there which made that easy to set up.
Okay.
And of course, you know, now after having listened to you, all paranoid, it's like, well, you know, are they easy to set up because somebody set them up wrong or because they got them right? Because when you talk about a high level, you know, oh, you want to use the highest level API you can, that in theory, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But of course, then you're trusting that those people who wrote the API didn't fall into the kind of traps which the rest of us as tourists would have fallen into. And of course, as a tourist, you can't judge whether they did or did not fall into it. So, and you know, it's, you know, there's no consumer reports of cryptography APIs. You know, there's nobody who says, you know, 5 stars or 3 stars. So you have to take what you can get as far as their reputation in the community.
Yeah. That's so much of this is entrusting that your library producers are doing their job. And so often it is just like, it's just another Joe programmer who's pissed off that about the situation, right, like you are, and he's basically a clone of you, and he was angrier earlier than you, and so he decided to bundle up in the library, and now he's not in any better position to know more than you.
Yep.
Angrier earlier. I think that's a good meme.
Yeah. There you go. All righty. To see the show notes for this episode, go to edgecasesshow.com, all one word, /61, and we'll see you next time.